call 00-0535 CR. Thank you, John D. Williams. We will have argument by Sandra. Is it Nowak or Novak? Nowak, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Nowak.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Attorney General Sandy Nowak. I represent the people of the state of Wisconsin. During this argument, the state is going to ask this court to essentially act on three issues, one of which has a subpart, so if you'll bear with me. The first is the state asks this court to reject the Court of Appeals rule that in closed cases, plea agreements should be construed in favor of the defendant. First, because it is inapplicable to the question at issue here, that is, of whether undisputed terms were indirectly breached by the prosecutor's comment in a disputed sentencing. And second, because the rule is unworkable, it's not helpful, and it's not supported by precedent in this state. The second action the state asks this court to take is to uphold and revitalize the rule that when either party claims that a plea agreement has been breached, the party claiming the breach must establish, by clear and convincing evidence, that a breach has occurred and that the breach was material and substantial. Finally, the state would ask this court to reinforce the factors found in existing precedent to determine whether a breach has occurred, as summarized in the state's brief at pages 22 and 23. Specifically, and this is where the three subparts come in, this court should emphasize that courts should look to an entire record to determine whether the true essence of a plea agreement has been breached, and give weight to the party's statements regarding their position on whether the court should follow the plea agreement, particularly if, as in this case, there is evidence that the statement of commitment to the agreement was made in good faith. Second, that this court should emphasize that the party claiming an indirect breach because of information acquired after the plea was entered must establish, by clear and convincing evidence, what the information was and that the other party suggested dissatisfaction with the agreement, not merely that the party conveyed negative information about the defendant. And finally, the state would ask this court to emphasize that it is permissible for a prosecutor to relate victims' views as long as the prosecutor clearly identifies those views as being from the victim, and essentially the same rule would apply with the pre-sentence writer. Taking the third part of my suggestions first, with regard to this case in particular, the Court of Appeals took issue with the fact that the prosecutor mentioned statements from the pre-sentence writer and statements from the victim. In this case, the state would submit that the court should have considered whether there was a good faith basis consistent with the plea agreement for the prosecutor to have made those statements. Clearly in Wisconsin, the legislature has spoken firmly in saying that victims' rights are to be protected by all parties in the proceeding. There was nothing wrong with the prosecutor in this case bringing up the victim's views, especially because in this case, we must remember that this was a disputed sentence. Second,
is there a majority opinion in this case? I note, as you're thinking about that, I'll fill in the time. I note that your opposing counsel refers to Judge Brown's opinion as the lead opinion. And Judge Snyder referred to the opinions of the court as three-legged, I think, if I remember correctly. So, is there a majority opinion in this case? And if so, what does it hold?
I believe that there is, and to the extent that both the the lead opinion and the concurrent opinion found that there was a breach of the plea agreement in this case, and both adopted that rule of the close case rule.
Okay, let's take the 2 points you made. It seems to me that the analysis to arrive at a breach between Judge Brown and Judge Snyder is very different. So the result, the conclusion might be the same, but the analysis and how they arrived at that bottom line as to whether or not there was a breach is very different. Do you agree or disagree with
me? I do agree with you in terms of that being my understanding of generally how a concurrence works. That is, we agree with your bottom line. We believe we agree with some of the rules of law, but we find another basis for the same position. So I do agree with you.
Are there two justices out of the three that are espousing a close case rule?
I believe so. But now that you say it, I couldn't swear that to be true. I believe that that is the case.
I'll tell you what's problematic, and that is, Judge, for me, and so I need your help on this, Judge Snyder never uses the term close case at all, and his analysis up until the very end has nothing to do with a close case whatsoever, in contrast to Judge Brown. But it does have a final paragraph, or something as close to the final paragraph, I have a slip opinion, I think, which is the second to the last paragraph. And he says this statement, the beginning of that paragraph: "The majority opinion correctly concludes that a case involving a prosecution plea agreement violation should favor the defendant." And that result is not unreasonable, and then continues on with that paragraph. Do you construe that then as Judge Snyder's adoption of the close case rule?
I do. And I think, if I may, that illustrates one of the problems with the close case rule. That is, it came from a Minnesota court, and the rule actually says that the agreement should be construed in favor of defendants. It doesn't say that whether or not a breach occurred should be construed in the favor of the defendant. And as I said in my brief, in some level that makes sense.
Yes, but the difference here is we're not talking about an alleged, this language, I wasn't sure what Judge Snyder meant by that language, because he's not talking, and just follows up exactly what you're saying, he's not talking about an alleged breach or a, if they're asserting a breach, he uses the term a violation. And I say to this, well, I agree with you. If there's a violation, it should, if the state violates something, then it should tip the hat to the defendant. If there's a violation, that's very different than if there is an alleged violation and you can't decide and you tip the hat in order to decide whether there's a violation. So I'm not sure what that means. That's why I'm asking for your help. Do you understand the difference I'm making? Because it's the very difference you just said. That is, if there's a violation, it tips the hand. You defer, you favor, if a violation has been established. In contrast to, do you tip to the defendant in trying to establish whether a violation has occurred?
If I can tweak that a little bit, what I'm saying and what I believe Witt says, and where I think the problem comes in with the Court of Appeals decision, is that when you're trying to decide what the terms of an agreement are, that's basic contract. And in that situation, the power really does, in some essence, lie with the state. That is, we hold the cards. When just trying to decide whether an, a violation has even occurred, never mind what happens after you've established a violation. Then the parties are on equal footing, and the court is in the best position on that equal footing basis to determine whether or not there has been a breach. And I also, I think, as I mentioned in my brief, an issue I have with that particular paragraph from the concurrence is that it ignores the benefits that defendants get out of plea agreements as well. That is, in this case, for example, there were particular counts that had been dismissed, and certainly oftentimes defendants don't want these things dragged out any longer than need be. So I think that has to be on that balancing scale as well.
What part of the Court of Appeals decision do you object to other than the bottom line?
I disagree with the Court of Appeals saying that merely by using language about the prosecutor's feelings or characterizing some of the behaviors that the defendant exhibited, that by mentioning how she felt about certain things that he had done, that also then led to her adopting what the victim and the pre-sentence writer had said. That is, I don't think merely because I use language to talk about the effect that a crime has on me, that means that I'm adopting the opinion of everyone who agrees.
Okay, well, let me just look at this. The Court of Appeals says that there may be evidence, there may be material that the prosecutor is obliged to tell the court, or should tell the court. And is it the state's position that you're obliged to review the preliminary sentencing?
It is.
You're obliged to do it. Well, they say in paragraph 9, prosecutor has no need to discuss the PSI or Valerius' testimony. Court has it in its possession. Valerius was going to be in court planning to testify. In short, the prosecutor did not need to provide any of that information. The court already had it or was about to get it. You disagree. You think we should write that it's up to the state to review the PSI and the victim's testimony with the court.
Well, I disagree in this case because that's actually factually not correct. I'm taking a step back. In some ways, this case is like a game of telephone where something is said on this end and as it comes out at the end, it's something completely different. In fact, the pre-sentence writer in this case never talked to the victim. The pre-sentence writer in this case never talked to the victim. So for the court to have suggested that the Court of Appeals to suggest that the trial court already had that information is not.
But it was going to get it. Didn't Valerius ultimately say something to the court?
No, she did not. She wrote yes, she did. The victim did.
Yes. So didn't the court have the PSI?
Yes.
And then the court was going to hear from the victim, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So now why does the state want the prosecutor in a plea agreement to report the PSI and the testimony, the victim's testimony to the court?
Those are two different questions.
Okay.
Respectfully, because in this case, prosecutors always have the right to argue for a sentence that they're proposing, specifically in a case like this where it's a disputed sentence. The considerations of the character of the defendant or the effect of the crime on society or the victim are perfectly reasonable information for the prosecutor to provide for the court.
To substantiate the plea agreement?
No, not the plea agreement, to substantiate the state's recommendation.
Okay, that's what I meant, to substantiate the state's recommendation. So you say, well, the victim is going to say this and this, but put in the total contents, I still think it's our recommendation is good, right?
Yes.
But that, isn't that what the Court of Appeals is objecting to? But that isn't what they interpret the assistant district attorney is saying. They are interpreting the assistant DA as saying, I need this plea agreement, and I'm recommending on the basis of that probation 60 days, right?
That's correct.
But I didn't see the PSI before I agreed to do that. And I didn't talk to Valerius before I did it. But and you're going to hear all this evidence, and man, I was surprised. But I nevertheless, I'm not backing off my recommendation, right? Isn't that what the, boy, that's, if I were the judge, I'd sure say, well, you're not backing off the recommendation, but you sure are an enthusiastic lady.
First of all, she doesn't have to be enthusiastic. She just has to do what was agreed to. But secondly, I think what's important in what you just said is
but
there
not undermine it. I mean, that's not fair.
That's correct.
Right? We're talking about fairness.
Right. But what is required for fairness, and the courts talk about, is the true essence, is what happened here so in opposite to the plea agreement that the person didn't get what they bargained for. Here, there's no specific language. First of all, there's no information in the record that says when the prosecutor talked to the victim. She may have talked to the victim in advance of the pre-sentence investigation, in advance of the plea, and I would hope that she did. That fundamental assumption isn't supported in the record. Secondly, the prosecutor never says anything about not supporting the agreement. In a case, for a practical matter, in the circuit courts, someone is facing 2 years in prison. To get 60 days jail time as a condition for a nonviolent offense takes some persuasion, as well it should. And in this case, if you look at, I think Justice Nettison makes a really good point in the dissent when he says, what did the prosecutor really do here? What she said was, a man who didn't support his child for all these years was a condom manipulator, and he should be held accountable because of the impact that that had on the child. And I think that that is reasonable, and there's nothing demonstrated in the record where she says, I'm sorry I made this agreement, which is what Poole said. Poole required specific language relating to the agreement. And I think without that specific language saying, you know, I'm sorry we're stuck with the agreement, or I may wish that I hadn't made that agreement, but I did. Without that specific language, I think there's a good faith. The prosecutor, in good faith, made negative comments about the defendant. It doesn't mean that it's inconsistent.
It seems to me that that test is just subject to a lot of abuse. If you say that the only way that a breach of agreement can be found on behalf of the state is if they specifically disclaim it. I mean, I can conjure up, as I'm sure lots of imaginations can, you know, the agreement is 5 days, and then you go, I mean, you start giving this litany of horribles and that would really justify 5 years in prison. But you don't say the words 5 years in prison, but you say everything else that anyone rationally would give them 5 years in prison. But, Judge, I just want to reaffirm 5 days and $5 is what we agreed to. I mean, that's problematic.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address
that. You are welcome.
Because I think I may have been less than precise in my response, and I genuinely mean that. And again, if I may be so bold as to refer you to page 23, there are a number of ways in which you can prove even an indirect breach. For example, the situation that you're describing, I think, is closer to Will's. That is, the prosecutor, on its face, does exactly what she's supposed to do, but then says things that, and you picked up on that language, I believe, that no reasonable person could have believed was consistent with the plea agreement. That's not the case here. Here he's claiming that she implicitly, based on new information, changed her mind about entering into the plea agreement. And at the very least, he should have to demonstrate what information she had that caused her to change her mind. Because here, the pre-sentence investigation report contained no information that the prosecutor didn't already have at the time that she
was. Is that clearly the record?
It is, if you start from the record, as I say, as the case sort of evolved out, There were all kinds of extrapolations about what happened here, but yes.
Is it clear in the record that the prosecutor had the criminal history and juvenile record of the defendant at the time the prosecutor entered into the plea agreement?
Yes, it is. I believe the prosecutor used the criminal history in a bail argument early on. And for that matter, I would point out that with the clear and convincing burden of proof, it's up to the defendant to establish. If he's making the claim that she now has information she didn't have before, he should have had to establish that she did, in fact, first talk to the victim after the plea agreement was entered. It could have been accomplished through a simple question and answer, and that wasn't done here. There's no indication of when she talked to the victim. And in fact, if you look at what's probable is with the victim rights legislation, she probably was consulted. So, but back to your original question, I think the situation that you described is a different sort of case of implied breach than is before the court today.
To determine whether there's been a breach, what's the standard of review?
Clear and convincing. The pardon, the person, oh, it's a mixed question, I'm sorry, a mixed question of fact and law. If the parties dispute facts.
Are there any disputes of facts here?
Yes.
What's the dispute?
For one, and some of the disputes didn't arise essentially until the Court of Appeals opinion, but I think the basic dispute is about what the prosecutor was referring to when she mentioned a contrast. And I'll give you that it takes a little reading to understand exactly what played out. But if you look at the first motion that Williams filed, they actually put in brackets that when she referred to a contrast, she was referring to a difference between what she knew before the pre-sentence investigation report and what she knows now. The trial court said, I don't think she was talking about a difference in the sentencing. I think she was talking about the difference in the relationship that the mother had with the child as opposed to the relationship that the defendant had with the child. And if you read the prosecutor's statement in context, that bears out. Now, what the state's position is that is a question, issue of fact, determined by the trial court, what she was referring to. It is then a question of law whether making that statement would have violated the breach. Because it was the trial court who was there. Sometimes if you read transcripts, I've read my own and I've been shocked and amazed that I wasn't as crystal clear about what I was saying. But if you were in the courtroom, you may have understood me better.
Well, your position is that this is what she was doing in contrast was a difference in the relationship between the mother's and the father's relation to the child.
That's
nothing
correct.
To do with what she knew or didn't know.
That's correct. And that is important because when I'm talking about what I think a party needs to show when they're talking about an implicit brief, if she had said, there's a contrast in the way I see this guy now than the way I did before, then I think we have a mental breach.
I understood you to say that two members of the Court of Appeals adopted a provision in the Soda case. Your argument is they really changed Wisconsin law. There's a case, Cook versus Cook, that I suspect you're familiar with. The Court of Appeals may not overrule, modify, or withdraw language from previously published decision of the Court of Appeals. Did the Court of Appeals here violate Cook versus Cook?
Respectfully, I believe so. I believe that the rule of law that this court has set forth, that constitutional protections are taken care of when either party establishes by clear and convincing evidence that a breach occurred and that the breach was material and substantial, doesn't give room for the Court of Appeals to say, well, if it's a close case, we're going to decide it in favor of the defendant, because substantial material says something right there. But that's not a cloud. If they don't cut it, if they don't prove it, they don't make their claim.
Well, the court of Appeals on 6 says, we agree with these jurisdictions, referring to Minnesota, and adopt the view that in close cases, the agreement should be construed in favor of the defendants, not breach, but the, how what the agreement is. And construing an agreement is ordinarily a question of law. So the clear and convincing evidence stuff doesn't make any sense on a question of law. So I don't see what's the matter with the statement that agreements, the plea agreement should be construed in favor of the defendant. What's the matter with that as a principle of law?
First, it has never been specifically stated in this state that that's the case.
Okay, but then secondly, the Court of Appeals can state a new principle of law, okay, without violating anything else. Go ahead.
But in this case, because the court said that there was no question of fact, and this may actually be supporting your question, position, the court must have been talking about the rule of law, because they said there was no question of fact here. And to say that, as a matter of law, the standard should be less than the clear and convincing standard undermines all of the social policy or the public policy issues that put the clear and convincing burden there in the first place.
But isn't the clear and convincing standard on the breach, right? And we were talking about whether or not there's been a breach is clear and convincing.
And that the breach was substantial and material.
Arguably, the Witte case. Is there any distinction to be made between the agreement, construing an agreement in favor of an ambiguous agreement, applying contract law, construing an ambiguous agreement in favor of the defendant? Is there any problem with that? I'm following up on the Chief's question.
I see that my light's on. If I can answer that question, I think that there may not be a problem in that, but it's not been established as law in Wisconsin. But because there's no case that I could find that said in ambiguous terms they're construed in the favor of the defendant in this jurisdiction. There are in other jurisdictions, and applying contract principles, that may be the case, but I don't think this court needs to get there. And if I can finally wrap up, if I can take just a moment to...
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay, counsel.
Mr. Prey, John Prey, from the Legal Assistance Program in Madison, representing Mr. Williams.
Good afternoon. It's more properly the Remington Center now, but it used to be LAIP. I want to talk about a few things today. One that has been mostly missed, and I think it's our greatest point, is talking about what exactly constituted the breach today. And some things have gotten missed here, and I want to cover that. I want to cover the burden of proof, which is the clear and convincing, and the close call rule, and then the standard of review. Maybe I'll just start with that. I agree. Mixed question. Here, there are no undisputed facts.
No disputed facts or undisputed?
There are no disputed facts, did I say that wrong?
Right.
The plea agreement is unambiguous and clear of what it was. It's also clear what the prosecutor said that allegedly is a breach of the plea agreement. Well, the only question is really a legal question, which this court can answer without deference to the trial court. Is this or is this not a breach? Let's start with the breach from there. This hasn't really been covered. When a defendant pleads guilty, it's usually in exchange for something valuable, generally, often a sentence recommendation. And a recommendation by a prosecutor is extremely important. It's given a lot more weight than a defense recommendation because there's the belief that the state should be recommending what is the appropriate sentence. But just because the prosecutor states what the recommendation was does not mean that it's really kept its promise. It's not really a recommendation if the prosecutor communicates that they don't really want that recommendation to be followed. You don't have to say those in explicit terms that you are denouncing the recommendation. That would be too easy in a case for this court, for any court. So but you can certainly imply that.
So what can the prosecutor say? What are the limits? Here, I'm just rereading what you said here. And Judge Nettesheim makes this clear in his dissent. The prosecutor, as he said, is not a potted plant. He or she, when you have this plea agreement, this information was available, so he or she should just say nothing or help, or because there is an agreement, then nothing should be said. What should they say, or what can they say in a plea agreement?
I think they can say lots of things in a plea agreement.
But they cannot say anything that would be in any way adverse to the defendant. Meaning that if the judge went outside of the agreement, and judges aren't held to plea agreements either. I mean, obviously they don't, they can do it, they have on their own discretion. What I'm asking is, what do you think, in this case, the person could have referred to with this information available?
Let me answer that first by saying there's at least two things you can't say, which were done here. You can't say, my mind has changed. And in so many words, which I'll point out in a minute, that's what the prosecutor said, that I changed my mind. Didn't say it quite that explicitly. Second, you can't say information that would undermine the agreement. This was an agreement for probation. It would make no sense to get up and say, I recommend probation, and want the court to know, this is the worst case I've ever seen. The individual is incorrigible, and you can't.
But he
thinks that's undermining.
That's in the Ferguson case. That's just wonder. But he didn't. That wasn't said.
Yes. You can. You can't say it if it is inconsistent with what your plea agreement with. In Ferguson, he did. The prosecutor did say some words about the defendant being a sleaze. I think was the word.
Among others.
In that case, he was also advocating for a maximum state sentence, and it was in the spirit of that. So I think you have to look at the words to see if it's in the spirit of probation or a larger sentence.
Mr. Prey, it strikes me when I read Judge Brown's opinion, that maybe you and the state don't disagree about many of the statements of law here, but that you disagree about how they apply in this case. So I'm wondering whether you agree that the prosecutor need not discuss the PSI or the victim's testimony. Do you agree with that?
I think the prosecutor certainly can introduce a victim. In this case, didn't need to go much further than that because the victim could speak for herself. But certainly if the victim doesn't wish to speak because she's intimidated or has some reason, just doesn't want to speak, I think the prosecutor can clearly get up and say, I've talked to the victim in this case. She would like the man to hang from his fingernails or whatever. I think she can say that. But I think you have to then say, however, I want to make it clear that is not our recommendation. I believe that he should get probation.
Can the prosecutor comment on the victim impact? Independent of saying what the victim is advocating for.
I think the prosecutor can talk about what the victim impact was as long as it's in the spirit of, and that's why I want probation and 60 days jail. So I think the prosecutor could have said almost anything as long as it's tied into, and that's why I want probation.
So you agree with paragraph 12. Will you reiterate that a prosecutor is not required to advocate for a bargain sentence enthusiastically, citing Poole, and may inform the court about the character of the defendant, even if negative? You agree with that?
Yes, I do. But I think, again, it still has to be in the spirit.
Well, that's what then they say. But you can't personalize it, adopt the same negative impressions, and then remind the court that that there's all been much harsher. What they wind up saying is that you can't put all this negative stuff in And then just also say, I'm not changing my recommendation. But that's because if I read the Brown decision, right, he reads what happened as being, although the prosecutor says, I'm not changing my mind, everything that she said indicates that she has changed her mind, and she's just not. Because if she says, I've changed my mind, she's got to say the defendant has a right to withdraw the plea, right?
Yes, of course she can't. You know,
the breach, right, okay.
Yeah. It just wasn't quite as explicit, but to me, the language that she used was explicit, and I think that's what the state has missed here. And if I might, I'd like to point
that's
out...
That's the difference between you and the state. I don't think you disagree about the rule of law. I'm leaving out the clear case issue. But you don't disagree the state had a right to introduce, to talk about the PSI, to talk about what the victim is going to say, to raise negative matters about the defendant. Your position is, though, that they had to then state clearly and carefully that there, nevertheless, the recommendation stands.
Anything less is not a recommendation. Okay. It's a sort of a recommendation. It's mouthing some words, but then implying, I don't really mean it.
Then do we get the right to review this record independently of the Court of Appeals? In the Court of Appeals, independently of the trial court, to then make the determination whether there's been a breach?
Yes. It's a pure legal standard. There's no findings of fact here. The state believes there was a finding as to the contrast statement, which I'll get to. I don't think that was a finding at all. And I also, well, let me get to that in a second. Let me just point out a couple things, because it hasn't been said yet. First of all, when they brought up she stated the recommendation, the prosecutor didn't even exactly state what it was. It started out, when Mr. Williams entered his plea, we said we would be recommending something. I'm not saying that's a breach in itself, but it starts you out on the wrong foot by bringing into the period of time, well, when we agreed, we said we would recommend that. And then immediately after that, she says, after reading the pre-sentence. And this is the most offensive part of it. After reading the pre-sentence, which is, of course, something that's only produced after the time of the plea, after reading the pre-sentence, it appears I can describe him as manipulative and unwilling to take responsibility. Now, could you say, could the prosecutor have gotten up and said, I find he is manipulative and unwilling to take responsibility, and that's why I want to be sure you put him in jail for 60 days and get him on probation? Absolutely. But you can't say, after reading the pre-sentence investigation, that's when I decided that he was manipulative. Then the state goes on, or the prosecutor went on, to talk about this so-called contrast statement. It was quite a contrast speaking with Mrs. Valerius and reading and learning about Mr. Williams. Now, the state here today says there's no reason to know when this conversation with Ms. Valerius occurred. I absolutely disagree with that, because her exact statement is it was a contrast speaking with her and reading and learning about Ms. Valerius. She had just talked about the pre-sentence report in the sentence before. Obviously, she's talking about the pre-sentence report and what she learned from Mr. Williams. Then, the contrast statement itself. Frankly, when I did the post-conviction motion, I just thought the only conceivable way this could be was contrasting what she thought before and after. The state then said, well, it could be a contrast between Mr. Williams bad, Ms. Valerius good. That's the contrast she's talking about. I suppose that's some kind of possibility. However, I don't really think it matters. It doesn't matter, because you're still talking about something you learned after reading the pre-sentence investigation. It's new information. And whether you learned, and whether that contrast has to do with Mr. Williams bad, Ms. Valerius good, or contrast what I thought before and what I thought now, it doesn't matter. It's giving information that you now have learned. about the defendant that is obviously troubling or negative.
What's wrong with that?
So that's the problem.
What's the legal problem with that?
What's the problem with that?
You said that that's a problem. Why? What's legally wrong with it?
What's the problem with it is because it's indicating that you have learned something new that you didn't know at the time of the plea.
So what?
And so that signals to the court that you wouldn't have, that you're dissatisfied with your agreement, your plea agreement.
Isn't that kind of a leap?
I don't think so. I think if you say, I pled guilty, you pled guilty to something, and then after that, and then you come into sentencing and say, after we agreed, after we made the plea agreement, here's some things I learned about him. And all you say is negative things about him, and then note that the pre-sentence investigation report wants prison. I think that's an unmistakable signal that you have learned some things and that you're dissatisfied with the agreement that you set forth before.
Well, I was, again, reading the same book you are, looking at, and Judge, this is on B4, if I indicated anything other than what our recommendation is, pre-sentence was here. We're prepared to go to sentencing, and the agent relayed this information. I'm merely supplying the court with that information. I'm in no way suggesting that I'm asking the court to adopt the agent's recommendation. So then they finish up. I won't go through all of it, but they say that the sentencing court should have all the information necessary. I'm merely relaying it. And so again, I will reiterate, Judge, that we are standing by a recommendation, and I have not changed that. And that's why I started out by saying we were recommending 3 years probation. So the position that you want this court to take is that if there's any negativity that's, let's say, stated by the prosecutor, and then the judge goes outside of the agreement, that is a breach.
I think the breach was done at that point, and it certainly the reaffirmation helped, and this would be a little easier case to argue if that hadn't been done, been stated. However, the breach had been completed, and it was too little, too late. Later to say, well, here's what I meant. I didn't mean to address that.
Mr. Prey, was there any dispute here as to the length of time in jail? Apparently they agreed on probation. They agreed that there would be a condition of probation of time in jail. Was there a dispute as to the amount of time in jail that would be imposed?
The prosecutor agreed to recommend 60 days jail. The defense didn't have any binding amount of jail. So that was the prosecutor's recommendation.
Doesn't that somewhat explain the prosecutor spending some time talking about what's in the pre-sentence and talking about what the victim said about the defendant?
I think if the comments had gone towards, and that's why I want 60 days in jail, it certainly would have. And some of those comments could have been easily turned around by the prosecutor to say, I want you to know he's not responsible and manipulative, and that's why I want 60 days in jail. That would be one thing. But I think in the totality, in the atmosphere of here you have a pre-sentence investigation report asking for prison time, in that atmosphere to say that you needed to say those many negative things to make sure you got your 60 days jail, I don't think that adds up.
Counsel, it was my understanding with regard to Justice Crook's question, a little different than yours, and perhaps I'm wrong. I understood the state made a recommendation. The transcript, which is part of the state's, I guess, appendix, indicates that there was testimony that went a couple of ways, but then I think it was on maybe page 119, I can't recall exactly, but that suggested there really wasn't anything in the record except that the defense asked for an adjournment to get medical records, and the judge may have inferred then that it wasn't a joint recommendation as to time, but there was nothing in the record. There was, for a while, there was testimony that I don't remember if it was a joint recommendation. Then there was a statement that it was a joint recommendation. And then later on the transcript, you get there's nothing in the record. And I guess that's what I...
Yes, I think that was an error that I made early on in the proceedings. I had assumed and thought it was...
Turns out it was not a joint. It was a joint recommendation for probation. There was not an agreement as to a recommendation that it should be 60 days in jail.
Thank you.
Counsel, early in your argument, you referred to two things that the prosecutor can't say. I missed the first one. The second one was anything that undermines the agreement. What was the first one?
Well, I don't know. To me, that's an overarching one of the two. Right, the two things, I think, are you can't imply or explicitly state or imply that your things have changed. And that was done here by saying, after reading the PSI and the contrast statement, you can't say you've learned new things that now lead you to believe, to think that wasn't a good idea.
But that certainly comes under the rubric of undermining the agreement.
Yes. The second, I think, is to make general comments that don't support the recommendation. So, and that comes under the parts about going on about what Ms. Valerius would say, what the pre-sentence recommended, and things that weren't really necessary to do to, it didn't support the 60-day with probation term.
So you can't expressly say, I changed my mind, and you can't indirectly say you changed my mind by giving information that undermines your recommendation.
You can't expressly say I changed my mind, and you can't say things like were said here, after reading the PSI, I find him to be irresponsible.
So it's a direct or indirect, I changed my mind.
Right.
And those come right, and I think the state would agree, those two premises come right from case law, from Hansen and Poole.
I think this is a straight Poole case. That's basically what happened in Poole.
The state sets forth standards, and their one and two are Hansen and Poole, and it's what you just said they set forth on page 20.
That's right.
And the difference is whether you think that what was said fits those two no-nos or it doesn't fit the two no-nos.
Yeah. I think there may be other things I haven't thought about that could be breaches. Those are the two problems in this case. There may be more, but I can't think of them right now. But those are the two that are present here. So I think it's just like, to me, in Poole, where the defense attorney, or I mean, the prosecutor said, here's the agreement, but that was the agreement before we knew of other instances, there's a probation revocation there, before we knew of that. That's an almost identical statement. Here it's, in Poole, it's before we knew of other information, we made that agreement. In our case, in Williams's case, it's after reading the pre-sentence investigation and reading and learning about Mr. Williams, here's what I think of.
I would just like to clarify something that I thought I heard you concede early in your argument. You said that you believed that it was not a breach of the plea agreement for the prosecutor to comment on the PSI or to comment on victim impact. Is that correct?
It's not a breach in of itself to comment on that as long as it's consistent with the recommendation.
And so to the extent that the Court of Appeals opinion says otherwise, you would agree it has to be overruled?
Yes. They certainly felt that it went beyond what was needed and it didn't support the recommendation. It supported prison.
Well, the Court of Appeals rule of law, as I read it, well, there are many rules that are established in the Court of Appeals opinion, one of which you haven't gotten to yet, and I'd like you to close case, the adoption of the close case rule from Minnesota. But one of the other rules that this opinion stands for is that a prosecutor shouldn't comment on negative information in a PSI or negative victim impact information, otherwise he or she risks being held in breach of a plea agreement, because they made a very broad sweeping statement about that, and you would agree that that needs to be pulled back from.
I think I agree to the extent it risks it. It doesn't necessarily mean it. I think you can say negative information, but again, it has to fit what you're recommending. So it's not an automatic yes you can or no you can't. I don't think the Court of Appeals was really saying that it's automatic.
that if you talk about those things, it's necessarily a breach. I don't read it that way, and I don't think that should be the rule, really.
Well, paragraph 9 and paragraph 12 don't sit very well together.
Paragraph 9 in whose decision? Oh.
Prosecutor had no need to discuss the PSI, and then in 12 it says, prosecutor may inform the court about the character of the defendant, even if it's negative.
I think I agree. There was no need to say that. On the other hand, I don't say it's an automatic breach just because she said, here's what it said. But in the totality of these circumstances, if you look at the whole thing, it did cross the line. But I don't read them to say that that's automatic, that you can't ever say, by the way. I think it'd be fine to say, I note the pre-sentence investigation is asking for prison. Here's why I don't think you should do prison. I think 60 days jail is enough here. Let's get them out to work a job so we can pay child support, you know, or something.
So the breach was the prosecutor's failure to link the comments that she was making about the negative information to the recommendation to 60
yes.
days jail? So if she had said those magic words, it would be okay.
That was one breach. The other was this temporal quality of saying after reading the change of mind situation. I think it's both.
So she should have said, I've read the pre-sentence and here's what I think, instead of after reading the pre-sentence, here's what I think. And we're hanging. The whole case hangs on that then.
No.
Much of
both those are equally, you can't say either one. You can't say, I read the PSI and you have to bring it down to the probation of 60 days jail.
Okay, so she should have said the magic words, and everything I just said, Judge, relates to my recommendation to 60 days in jail.
That would have been fine.
And so her failure to make that conclusory statement is what the case hangs on.
Well, there may be other ways to say it than that, but that'd be certainly one way you could say that, yes.
And the fact that she did say that at the very end, and this goes to Justice Wilcox's question, doesn't fix it. Because in your view, it came too late.
Came too little too late, and the breach had been completed by then.
Okay, what about the close case rule?
Close case rule. It's interesting how they came up with that. We hadn't proposed that in our briefs, as you may know, and it is...
Did not.
We didn't really talk that much about the burden of proof, but I think we thought it was clear and convincing, and the state hadn't briefed that, and then the Court of Appeals came up with this close call rule. And I've read this opinion many, many times, and frankly, it's difficult to know what exactly they're talking about. What's the burden they're putting it on? Is it synonymous with if you don't know if it's a breach, then it is? Or is it preponderance standard? Or is it something close to clear and convincing? If it's close to clear and convincing, then it's a breach. I don't really know.
I mean, when you're talking about rules of construction, and that's the way this rule is phrased, that we construe plea agreements in favor of the defendant. When you're talking about rules of construction, you're generally talking about a situation where there is a dispute about what the agreement means.
Yes.
Right?
That's true.
We don't have that here.
That's right.
And that really wasn't present in the Witte case either.
That's right.
So the Minnesota court just adopted wholesale the language of construction of agreements onto a determination of whether there was a breach, which is subject to a very different sort of a standard. It's a burden of proof kind of a measure, and it's a high burden of proof in this state anyway, clear and convincing evidence of a substantial and material breach. And when you're talking about burdens of proof in a close case, we say the burden has not been met. We don't put a thumb on the scale for anybody. We say the person who has the burden of proof has to meet the burden of proof, and if the case is close, it by definition has not been met. So this close case rule completely guts the burden of proof, whether it's clear and convincing or preponderance of the evidence, right?
Well, I don't know if it guts it. It doesn't necessarily gut a rule to say we're going to let it slip a little bit. If it's close to clear and convincing, although that may seem contradictory, if it's close to... Here's how I would propose it. If reasonable minds could differ as to whether the clear and convincing burden has been met, then we're going to say the burden has been met.
Doesn't that by definition just lower the burden of proof or change the rules of evaluating burden of proof? Because when we instruct juries about burdens of proof, we tell them if it's a tie, then the burden has not been met, right?
Yes.
So doesn't that completely change the whole nature of burdens of proof?
Well,
by telling the fact.
It depends how far you slip it down. I think it can slip somewhat, and I think there's good reason for a close call rule. I don't think they have to be symmetrical. It is far different for a prosecutor to recommend a plea, to breach a plea agreement, than a defendant. If let's say there's a plea agreement to a joint recommendation for 10-year sentence, and the prosecutor comes in and says, I recommend 10 years, but that was before I really knew about the guy and my opinions changed. That's obviously bad, and I think that's kind of what happened here. If the defense came in and said, yeah, it's a joint recommendation for 10 years, but tell you the truth, my client would like less than that. That doesn't really shock anyone's sensibilities, and everyone knows the defendant would like less time. But the prosecutors have a duty to uphold justice, and people have to rely on prosecutors, and the whole plea bargaining system can come collapsing if people don't think they're going to get what they bargained for. So it's far more important, I think, for prosecutors to be held to a stricter standard. And I think that's what the close call rule is doing, is to say there's a special need to hold prosecutors strictly to what they promise.
Don't we really reach that same result by lowering the standard or keeping the standard at clear and convincing? I mean, why inject new language when we have language from past cases that probably is close case? Clear and convincing. In other words, the scale only has to tip a little bit. Isn't that what a close case is?
I think it is, yes. For the reasons I just said, I think there's reason to let that standard be not quite so clear and convincing. But maybe I didn't say this yet, and I need to emphasize it before my time runs out. I don't think you even need to reach this rule at all, because I think we have met our burden by clear and convincing evidence. So if you agree with that, then I don't think you even have to take on this rule.
Well, we have to say something about it, because this is a published opinion, isn't it? I mean, we have to say whether we agree with the rule or whether
you don't have to decide the case on it, I guess, if you think it's clear and convincing. I think it's clear and convincing, and I think we can carry that burden whether it's clear and convincing or close to clear and convincing, whatever that means, whether that's however far down the scale you go on that.
I don't understand this a bit. It's clear and convincing what? That there has been a breach? You have to show by clear and convincing evidence.
Clear and convincing that there's a breach, yes.
Okay. How does that fit with what we started out with in your argument, that if there's a breach or not, it's a question of law? I mean, if it's a question of law, it's not an evidentiary question of clear and convincing. Right?
I'm not sure. To tell you the truth, the standard of review and the burden are very difficult to distinguish.
That's why I think we have to put it together. Now, we often say in opinions, which also doesn't make sense, you have to prove a statute is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't know how you prove an issue of law beyond a reasonable doubt. But clear and convincing means that there's evidence that you're going to weigh, and it has to be persuasive more than by a preponderance. Then it just strikes me, if you do that, then you should be reviewing that by a standard of, are you clearly erroneous? Is it clearly erroneous?
Well, it's a question of law as to whether there was clear and convincing evidence. So the reviewing, this court could decide.
Okay.
So without deference,
is there clear
convincing evidence?
Okay. So the question of law, you think, is there clear and convincing evidence?
If that's the standard you want to go with. But if you want to go to the close call rule, then you have to apply that. My time's up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prey. Nowak?
Thank you, Your Honor. If nothing else, I hope that the past exchange has demonstrated for you why we don't need the close case rule, that it completely obfuscates what the parties have to deal with when they're approaching a disputed sentence. And that's what this case was, by the way. The state reads the record to say that this defendant could have asked for a $50 fine. There was no requirement that he be subject to probation. The prosecutor in this case did not have an obligation to argue against the pre-sentence investigation reporter's recommendation. She had an obligation to give enough negative information to justify the 60 days in jail.
Do you agree with Mr. Prey that at the very least the prosecutor can do nothing that undermines the agreement?
The question is what it takes to undermine the agreement. I think that a prosecutor can give negative information that supports what they want to have happen and not what the defendant wants to have happen.
But on a plea agreement, they both agree what should happen. I mean, they've agreed what the state can do. So I think that you have to answer Justice Babbage's question that they can't undermine what they've agreed to state. If they undermine it, they are not abiding by the agreement. They agreed to state A. If they undermine A, they're not, right? You can't do it directly or indirectly. You can't say, I don't agree with it, and you can't indirectly show that you disagree with your recommendation. Agree with that?
I do, but at points during Mr. Prey's argument, with all due respect, I heard him almost saying that the prosecutor here had an obligation to argue against the pre-sentence investigator's recommendation for prison, and that is not the case. That would be the distinction or the tweak I would make.
This is a recommendation. A recommendation, I haven't read in the dictionary, but I take it when we talk about a recommendation, when the prosecutor agrees to recommend, they are agreeing to support. Recommend means to support, to urge, to go along. So anything that's contrary to that, it seems to me, would be an undermining.
Is that
correct?
If it's and that's where the clear and convincing standard comes in, because they have to establish not only a breach, but that the breach was material and substantial.
Mm-hmm.
And so a simple statement that, I really don't like this guy, and I don't like him today, the fact that it's today, the chronology of how it happens doesn't make it a breach. The fact that she doesn't like him doesn't make it a breach.
Well, I'm just thinking,
as long as it's consistent with the 60-day recommendation.
The next case that comes up here, as the prosecutor is recommending this, he or she is shaking their head. So then the next thing we're going to have that, we get the sterile record, but they make grimaces from the bench. This is what I'm saying, that language is very important, but so are the actual trial court exhibits. So it's a tough standard, in my opinion, if you're requiring a prosecutor to always. A plea agreement does not mean they're agreeing on the plea, but they may not agree on the language or what was said. I mean, they could certainly express themselves in terms that may be negative. It's very hard to appreciate just where the line is. What is expected when you get into the? I was thinking as a trial judge of 14 years, and I took many plea agreements, and sometimes I went less than the agreement. I mean, obviously, I'm sure counsel wouldn't be here if it was 30 days. but because it was 18 months, then, which is a significant departure from the agreement. So it has some real pitfalls that I see in coming up with a good, clean standard. So this is more of a statement. I'm just wondering what you're saying, leave it as is.
I'm saying leave it as is with a little tweaking in terms of, I think we do need to go back to Poole, and I disagree. I think this is not a Poole case. In Poole, she specifically talked about the agreement and said, but essentially now I'm stuck with it. Here, the prosecutor had more information about the defendant, if you accept that, in the pre-sentence investigation, but that doesn't necessarily mean that even that additional information was enough to push over her opinion about the veracity or the wisdom of the plea agreement. In other words, she may now know more about him and know why he needs to go to jail for 60 days.
Maybe it's important to look at what the trial court judge said, because it didn't accept the recommendation of the trial judge that indicate that dissuaded by the negative evidence that was presented by the prosecution?
I don't recall that.
Thanks, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Nowak. Thank you, Mr. Prey. That ends our argument on 00-0535 CRA.